Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Mead, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friend. How are you?
Very good. That is like a very talk show looking curtain you have behind you there.
I know. It's either Joanne's fabric or Dick Cavett. It's one of the two that is happening right behind me here as I am in on property at Disney World. We're doing a little bit of a family tour to introduce my wife's pregnant belly to my family here in Orlando, but it is always important to talk to you, the Weird Things faithful.
Exactly. So we wanted to do the show. Brian is on a mission taking care of very important stuff, so unable to join us right now, so we're here because you are our mission, and you're important to us.
Exactly. He's on a bit of a cannonball run, as it were, which is a story for another day. But holy crap, did we have a hell of a week in the world of AI?
Yeah, it has been kind of crazy. There was a Monday announcement by OpenAI ahead of the Google I.O. announcement. And
totally coincidental, I imagine. I imagine these things happen, you know, just randomly, set in stone, months in advance.
Yeah, I would say that there's always some strategic thinking going in. Sometimes you just announce stuff when you're ready to announce. Sometimes there's strategic, you know, thinking there.
Business can be a competitive sport. I think that that's safe to say. And right now, this is the tip of the spear of all technology, what has been a cornerstone of the American economy for the last several decades. So this is certainly something that you can imagine either by happenstance or by design was supposed to invoke comparisons.
Yeah. Now, in interest of full non-disclosure here, I worked at OpenAI up until September, and so obviously,
what did you know, and when did you know it?
Well, I mean, the advantage is like they move so fast; a lot of things come out, and I'm like, "Cool, so I didn't know that." So I can speak to genuine surprise and stuff like that. And I'm, you know, obviously we wouldn't speak on anything that really isn't my place to speak to, but also there's so much isn't going on in that. There's so much history in that org since I left that I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. Didn't know that. But I can speak to about publicly available information, stuff like that. So GPT-4o was the big announcement. Okay.
Yes.
This was a model they announced on Monday, and they did a live presentation right from, the area in literally from the OpenAI facility, which is just like an area that's between the visitor wing.
And I was wondering whether or not that was a set. That is just a part of OpenAI HQ.
Yeah, they just moved some equipment around, put up a big screen TV. That is literally where I shot a lot of my videos, a lot of stuff there. Like that's OpenAI office. They just literally shot it from the office and did that, and they did it live. Live presentations always make me terrified, you know, as a live performer and a tech. To the credit of OpenAI, and a thing that I had to learn was, despite the silly, why is Open in the name? Why is Google called it? Why is Micro called Soft? It's a very big company. Why is it? It just. I went to Wendy's. She wasn't there. I'm angry, and so you get that level of discourse.
Yeah,
they do.
There's no corned beef hash at McDonald's.
Yeah, they try to, exactly, it's Scottish food in my butt. They try to do things, you know, what they consider, you know, they want, it's a safety-focused organization, right? And you can have an opinion of like, well, you should disclose everything. Well, I don't know, like, is that true? Like, if I knew there was an exploit that could, like, break every iPhone, should I tell the world first or Apple first? What would be the responsible thing to do? You know, and you can get to these things, you can say, like, it's hard, and you can say it's you can have an opinion, but it's hard to say the other opinion's completely wrong if you don't have a good answer for that. And that's like a zero-day exploit. You know, should the first thing I do is just go, if I found the Google master key, should I just publish them, be open so everybody knows? Like, well, no, because that'll cause a lot of damage. And AI is like that. Could be like that. Maybe it's not. Maybe really highly advanced AI is an overblown threat, whatever. And so you have to handle that responsibly. So one of the things that OpenAI tries to do is, and it's funny because I'll hear people like, oh, they're such hype machines. Like, do you know what my advertising budget when I was at OpenAI was? Zero.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't spend
any. That's lower than what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a YouTube channel. We put videos on the YouTube channel. We weren't producing commercials. We weren't doing anything. And people would say, oh, they hype. I'm like, where? Like Sam will get asked questions and give answers to stuff, you know, but like, it's just that perception because everybody talking about it.
The week before they made this announcement, he called his flagship large language model embarrassing.
Yeah, and he said that before.
Which I think would be the opposite of hype.
Yeah, he has said since ChatGPT came out, it's bad, it's not as good as it could be, whatever. We know where the future is going to be, and we know we're nowhere close to where the future is. So it's easy to say that. If this is your final product, then you're going to be like, this is great. But if you know what you're building and they're open, AGI, then that's people go, oh, is it really like AGI? So just a side little thing, people will go, well, you'll hear like, oh, they must be up against some wall because now they're doing all this product stuff. There are 1,000 more people at OpenAI than when I started, okay?
Yeah.
And you have a lot of marketing people and you have a lot of product people. The number of product people working at OpenAI went from like, do you know who built the first on-device demo of GPT-3 on an iPhone?
Would that be you?
It would be me. And I was, it was a part-time, hey, let me go show you what we can do. And I went in, you know, actually built in Flutter, showed a thing, it showed it talking, showing to do this very basic, very, very basic, wouldn't it be fun to do? And it was a cool thing. And everybody knew that's where they were going to go in a much better way. So you went from one guy in the evening going, hey, let me build a fun little demo to see what this would actually kind of look like. Wow, it's really slow. There's a lot of latency. Can't wait for the models to get better. To the most incredible product people in the world, you know, building applications for Mac, for Android, and for iOS. And so, of course, you're going to get more product. But it doesn't mean all the researchers left or playing Frisbee in Dolores Park.
Well, let's get to what they put out, that is specifically the new model 4.0 and then a few applications or updated versions of it. So where do you want to start?
So let me explain what 4.0 is, okay? GPT-4.0 takes several capabilities and put them into one model. And what do we mean by one model? Okay, a model essentially is a series of layers that make predictions, like algorithms. It's basically a network that makes a prediction. You give it an input, it gives you an output. A text model originally was, I take some words. We talked about this before, tokenizers. I break those words into numerical values. The word the might be 22.2, you know. The word monkey might be 44, 33, 66. A more complex word would be broken down phonetically, et cetera. And you create these numerical values, you put them into a grid, and you show it another grid, and the models learn to predict. It sees one sequence, predicts the next sequence.
Yeah.
Well, at heart, it's a prediction machine, which means I could take an image, and I can break an image down into numerical values.
Yes.
And I can have it predict, you know, what image comes next. I could take text and image tokens and have the text assigned to image tokens and then give it a new sequence of text and have it create a new image, which is how things like DALL-E work, right? So you can interleave text and image tokens together. So I can have a model that learns text and learns images at the same time. You can do that with anything that you can put into a tokenizer, including sound, right? And I can have it I can take a sound wave, tokenize it, put it into a model and have it predict what this means. And that could be have a sound wave and then give it an output of a transcript and train it in over time. And that's like Whisper, what Whisper learned to do, which is OpenAI state-of-the-art speech recognition model. So you can basically take these and not just have them be text or image or audio only. You can combine these tokens into a model, and over time, a well-trained model will be able to take any kind of input you have and also generate, as we saw with, you know, the image models, is it can learn to generate image tokens that can end up being images. And you can do the same thing with voice. I can train it how to speak by having it do this. Now, the way that ChatGPT works right now, when you do the voice mode, you speak, the Whisper transcription model turns your words into text,
okay,
and sends it to GPT-4. GPT-4 comes up with an answer, spits out text, and then that text goes to a speech synthesis model, voice engine, which they announced, and it converts it into audio. So you're going through three models.
Gotcha.
What GPT-4.0 does is it's one model. You speak to it. As your voice goes into it, it takes your voice, converts it into tokens, understands what you say, and then it generates a voice response. It's able to skip two sets. It doesn't have to go to an intermediate, this is the text response. It just goes straight to this is the voice response.
So how is that possible? What was limiting the was it an application limitation or was it a LLM limitation that prevented that from happening before?
Well, it was you have to get to there first. You got to build a good voice model, and you got to build a text model, and you got to build a good speech model, right? You got to build these separate models and understand how they work. Then you take your training data for those things and an architecture that works. And then you take all that training data and you train a model and you just say, these are speech tokens, these are voice tokens, these are this, these are output. So you build a model that then says, okay, instead of training three separate models, I'm going to train one model with all this together. And
so this old version of it was a that is just an evolutionary link in the chain that we will probably see less and less of as an omni model becomes more of the standard.
For many situations, yes. And so the thing to understand that the downside of an omni model is because it, and then also this omni model can also output images too. That's a thing too that kind of got underscored is that it does image recognition and it can output images, which means that you've got a very true multimodal model. And there have been approaches towards multimodality. Original GPT-4, there was a vision variant which could do vision recognition, which OpenAI, you know, I showed examples of that when we did the launch, but we didn't kind of go overboard into. So when Google came out with their Gemini Pro launch, it was a great opportunity for them to go, look what we can do. We can do video. Yeah. Like, well, you're doing a sequence of images just like GPT-4 Vision did. We just didn't draw a circle around it and call it video because that felt to us not quite accurate.
Honest. Yeah. Google, and we talked about it here that Google.
Let's separate.
Yeah.
Google researchers are the best, among the best in the world. As I know. Sure. I met the best ones at OpenAI when they go there. And there are people from OpenAI go there. I think they're incredible. They do great stuff, great research. I think had Google execs made a bet on them 5 years ago, it was 5 years ago that Microsoft did the $1 billion deal with OpenAI to scale up GPT-2 into GPT-3. Had Google been making the same sort of bets and had the confidence and was letting their science and engineer essentially do this sort of, I think we would be much further along than
they are now.
They'd
be there. Yeah.
They would not be playing catch up, and I still feel like they are. I think individually, they're great projects, DeepMind, stuff like this. So this is not Google. Like, there is an incredible amount of talent at Google. It just
I think that's been our stated thing. I need to state it though
because I don't want to be checked out of context or be the OpenAI guy. That's
Sure. Yes. But let's focus on OpenAI for now. So that is what makes Omni special with the apps. That was the other big thing: a Mac desktop standalone and a new version of the iOS app that shows off some of these capabilities in a much more exciting
way. Now the thing is that I think that the messaging probably wasn't as reinforced as well as it should have, because they talked about the Mac app was available that day, but it didn't have the cool features of the voice in, voice out. It didn't have just the share your screen and have it do that. That wasn't. So a lot of people were confused about, hey, what is this here? Whatever here. And so to make it clear, The new model, GPT-4o, has been deployed, but those capabilities have not. And knowing OpenAI timeline, that's weeks. It's not months. It's not never. And I will make a critique is to Google was, you know, there was comparisons because, like, Google did a thing last year where they showed off, or they did their demo of, Gemini Pro or Gemini Ultra, which is now vanished. And they showed this overhead, you know, the guy talking to the model. They had that fake sound, like a recording, like it's a test. It bothered me a lot, partially because it was frustrating. It was BS. Also, like I said, because I really respect the research Google researchers are doing, and it was not an accurate representation of where they were. But anyhow, that demo has never materialized in any product. You know, they showed that 6 months ago or whatever. It's never turned into anything. It was just, hey, look at this cool thing in the future. It's coming soon. What they did deliver was a very good multimodal model like GPT-4 that could take a sequence of images and reason across them. And they built some very good tooling to let you upload video and things like this. And so it was giving you that sense of that. So OpenAI announces GPT-4o and actually show on device these things working in the live. They did this thing live. And that's the thing. I think it wasn't just a live recording. They demoed this live. And there were flaws. There were points where the thing didn't quite understand what somebody was saying. They spoke over it, whatever. And I would say that was sort of the strength of OpenAI was they're like, hey, we feel good enough that, and we're close enough that we're going to show you this, what it does, and it'll get better. And by the time you have it, you'll be very happy.
And they showed it not working in a way that was easy to get it working. For me, the most exciting part of the demo was when they were taking questions from Twitter, and one of them was take a selfie and have the model guess what your emotions are right now. And the model spits out, I'm looking at a desktop. And that's obviously not what you want, because he's holding the camera right in front of his face. He says, no, that was a picture I took before. Take another look. Boom. The model gets it right. That, to me, is in an era where, largely because of AI, everything can look better than it is, and that's not unique to AI, but it is made worse by AI, that you can make things look, you can shade things, you can force perspective, especially in demos. That was, okay, this is street ready. This is ready to be downloaded. If that's the interaction that you're having and you're able to get over problems that fast, it shows that this is not a perfect weather version of it. And that I thought was extraordinarily impressive.
There's a dozen more videos on the OpenAI YouTube channel, which I love that they did. And it's other people who worked on the system demoing, like literally they all sat down at a desk and showed off their favorite cool thing they could do with it. Greg Brockman does a demo with it. And then his wife comes up behind him and she does little, bunny ears. And then he's like, did something interesting happen? And then the model recalls it. There's things like that. You watch this sort of thing, and sometimes the model has to think. But the really amazing thing was the latency, was how quick it was to respond. Yeah. And I, while I was there, I watched this in progress and just seeing week after week as it got faster and faster and faster and faster, and knowing what that threshold is for something to feel real time. And knowing that when we first launched GPT-4 with the voice capability, it wasn't going to be where we wanted it latency-wise, but we also had a clear path to know. We launched the version that was slower because we know how to make it faster. And I think that was one of the things I think about OpenAI, is that they'll put out a good enough version of a thing knowing that a better thing's going to happen. Another example of that was when ChatGPT came out. ChatGPT came out before GPT-4.
Yeah.
And they knew GPT-4 was coming out and it was going to be way better, but they went ahead and said, let's put ChatGPT out there also, so we understand how people interact with it, so we know how people use it.
Well, what was the internal phrasing? It was a low
low-key research preview.
There we go. A low-key research preview that wound up putting the entire company on the map and reshaping technology.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, just peeking behind the curtain, as I saw a writer who's been following AI for years, who I think is very, very astute, and one of these people that I give slightly more credibility to than a lot of other people comment on an AI who are just sort of jumping in with their opinions with no track record. He had just said, like, well, I think OpenAI just got lucky. They weren't the first to scale a transformer. They weren't, but they were the first to build a chatbot on LLM, and they got lucky. And I'm like, well, that's not exactly true. What's that?
Wasn't true. I mean, that's
there was I can name a number of LLM based chatbots before that, and that they certainly built a high quality one. And I think that also we at OpenAI, like, we knew multi turn conversations were going to be the way you'd interact with AIs, because the way you talk to people, that was the thing we knew, and the way you talk to people online or on your phone is in chat. And like I built, my AI channels app in 2020, which you look at, it had a version of what we'd call the GPT store. It was text-based back and forth messaging. And I don't sit around claiming, hey, everybody, I saw the future. I'm like, no, it was an obvious thing. It was if I were another person, I'd be like, I told them what it would be like. Like, no, like where do you talk to smart, intelligence now? In chat, people, like, why would AI be there? So there's a lot of just like, anyhow, I would say that my point is that, often they have the versions of the stuff you're seeing them do now were things OpenAI has been thinking about for years. The time frame at which things become possible depends a lot on what we learn and how to build it.
The iPhone app and the Mac app, why do you think now was the time to launch the desktop app? And what do you think a 4.0 model on iOS or on smartphones, how is that going to change how people understand LLMs? Because I'm very bullish on both, but specifically something that is as capable as 4.0 is on phones seems incredibly powerful, and I think we might be underrating it.
Yeah, so starting with the Mac app, the advantage of once you build a native application, and you know, they'll do Windows too, and you know, but like once you build a native application, you're able to do a lot more things at the system level. In the demos they showed, like just you can do screen sharing in a browser, but it's kind of kludgy. And if you can do it in an app, it's a lot more efficient. And also, you can make that app available. I'm in the middle of writing a book. Now, when I want to do some research, I just click Option Spacebar. And all of a sudden, the launcher appears, yeah. And I can just type my question and do that. You get that. It's about reducing friction. OpenAI learned a lesson, which everybody knew, but sometimes you have to experience to decide how to prioritize it, which was ChatGPT reduced a tremendous amount of friction. And then they did another thing, which was really important, is they got rid of sign-on. You can just go right to ChatGPT and use it without having to log in and create an account. Brilliant. And then... now, too, the thing is that they've said, too, is, hey, we've got this great model, GPT-4.0. This is going to be the default model for the free tier, too, okay?
Yeah.
And that's saying, yeah, we're going to give our best current model to everybody for free, and that means they're trying to create a category of experience. So the advantage of a Mac app is, a native app is, you know, they have the GPTs, and people, you hear this sort of like, GPTs, these are where you create your own custom sort of form of GPT, you know, interaction. The problem I've said at the time is people are going to look at this the wrong way. They're going to compare it to the App Store. And it's not the way the App Store was, a lot of people have the same problem. Somebody created a solution for me. I'll go buy it on the App Store. GPTs are often, I have a very unique workflow I need to do. So yes. I go in to the GPT builder. I tell it what I'm trying to do. And it spits out a GPT that I can then use and share it within my org or my team. I can publish it. The App Store was never that. The average app user on the iPhone was never building their own apps. There was never a function on the iPhone. That was a big criticism of the iPhone, was, you know, you didn't even have like Mac Automator or other tools to do that. So it wasn't like, hey, I need to, every time I get an email, I want to be able to press a button, have it do this, this, and this. Shortcuts and stuff came later, but those are so obtuse now, people don't even think about that. So that's the big difference, is you have to look at GPTs as a way to kill your own customized little systems. And right now there's an AI builder that helps you do that. You're going to get to the point where you're just going to go into the regular, I presume, the regular conversation thread and say, hey, I do this a lot. Can you write a GPT for me and then just save it and I have a workflow? So building it Mac first helps. Part of the story that kind of gets lost too is that OpenAI has been doing like insane enterprise business, like insane. There was just some data that came out like a day or two ago, which talked about they're by far the most dominant player when it comes to this kind of AI service by a huge margin. Their retention rate's something like 85%. 85% of people who try OpenAI, businesses try OpenAI, consistent with OpenAI, their spend rates increase over time. They start using this more and more. So building a tool like a Mac app.
These are the businesses. Like this is the money. When people talk about like how a tech company is profitable, there's a million that are more famous, but the ones that bought billboards trying to hire top-end engineers were back-end API companies that would buy the billboards coming in from the East Bay because they were making that kind of money. There's a million apps that you have that are probably losing money. In fact, there are probably video services that you may or may not be watching this video on that are currently losing money. The API is where you make cash, and right now it looks like OpenAI is either swimming in it.
It is, but also like the ChatGPT for enterprise, though. That's in the ChatGPT for enterprise is a huge thing, because what they've done there is instead of having to hire people in a company to go build a tool, we've got a really super intelligent AI. We just tell it what to do and we give it access to data. They're now just releasing a feature where in ChatGPT, you just connect right into your Google Drive and you can do things. And so a desktop app becomes, if you're in business, you probably have a Slack app. You probably have the Slack app downloaded on there and you use it. You know, you're going to have Microsoft Windows, you're going to have whatever, you're going to have a lot of these workplace things. And that's what ChatGPT becomes. It becomes not a website destination. It becomes a functioning app.
An internal. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can build things into it and do a lot of capabilities there and put it there. So for the phone is, you know, my wife uses ChatGPT all the time to talk to him, by the way. Fun fact, my wife, Roshni, the first non-OpenAI employee to ever have a ChatGPT subscription. First ChatGPT.
Hey, look at that.
It's my wife. And she uses it all the time. I go in there and she's talking to it, asking questions and stuff. And, you know, she's reading or researching. And that is going to be a normal way to do stuff. And that was what was exciting about GPT-4.0. You know, people made the comparisons to her. Well, I will tell you, at OpenAI, we looked for positive examples of interactions with AI, and her was the best one. And that was the thing, thinking about how do you have conversations with an AI? And, you know, I talked to it a bit. The biggest drawback has been latency. And, you know, and then, you know, the thing is latency getting improvement. Awareness will be another big factor when it knows when you're talking to it. But you're going to get to the point where you just leave it on. It's just going to be in a box in the corner and, you know, or running on your phone and you just use it.
You can just call it up whenever you want and talk to it for as long as you want.
It's like sitting in the room with you waiting for you to ask a question.
I'll tell you, I was driving today from Jacksonville, Florida, where I was visiting family, down to Orlando, and I saw just a random billboard for some beach bar, and it said, check it off your bucket list. And I was like, wait, was that a famous beach bar or something? Like, is it owned by somebody famous? So I've gotten so used to having that curiosity now being able to be answered for me in a real-time language thing that I just, you know, I clicked on my voice for ChatGPT and had a conversation with it to see whether or not it was anything famous. Spoiler alert, it wasn't. It was just a billboard in Flagler Beach. but that's something where as that gets hooked into more things and becomes more accessible, becomes faster, I can only see that happening more often, that any moment of curiosity or interest. And then we go beyond that. We go beyond what I'm thinking, which is essentially a better version of search. You go into, you know, how you're feeling and you know, whether or not you have a writing partner.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing really interesting results where clinically, we're finding these systems are really good. Therapeutically, there's mixed data. If people don't know they're talking to an AI, they're very upset. Predictably so. But, you know, analytical points of view, things like that. I think that learning how to use these things is going to be critical. And we're still figuring it out along the way. And I'm, you know, I come across, I'm super pro, but I also have concerns. It's like any tool that I've never had a really bad experience with social media because I understood what it was. It was people incentivized to leverage my attention however they can in any way they can, and sometimes not paying attention to that effect. The moment, you know, Facebook, like, I personally never went through shock of like, oh my God, you sold my data to who? Like, what do you think they are? And also from the nonprofit world, I can tell you stories about, you know, large-scale nonprofits that just really completely act against your interest in ways you don't think about, you know? And, you know, when Wikipedia is manipulating you, can you do? Yeah. Like, oh, the lights are going to get shut out if you don't give us $2 right now, you know?
A personal appeal by Jimmy Wales. OpenAI, I think it got a tremendous amount of accolades for what they announced, and what was interesting is what they didn't announce. And Sam Altman, the CEO, made it very clear before the Monday announcement that it wasn't going to be two things that have been very much speculated about and reported on, which is either ChatGPT-5, a generational uptick from 4, or a search product, which was reported, I think, a week prior that OpenAI was working on. For them to get the kind of reaction that they got without doing that, I thought was fairly impressive. It shows you where they are in the space right now.
Well, and a couple factors. We talk about like what could be next, but in they wanted to announce. They've been sitting on GPT-4.0 for a long time. You know, the iterations are the capabilities there, and they wanted to show hey, this is where we are, because also there means they're close to deploying it. And like I said before, ChatGPT came before GPT-4, and people were waiting for GPT-4 to come out. And they're like, "Hey, it wasn't like, hey, look at this amazing thing. Like, hey, here's a cool. Let's just try this thing." And then we sort of learned, like, "Oh shoot!" And so sometimes you get little announcements out of the way before big announcements is something. And I don't know here, but I could say that historically that's been that you kind of clear the deck of, because you have your release schedule, you have things at certain stages, and you know, a thing that they sat on for a year and a half was Voice Engine, which got didn't get a lot of attention, which was their voice cloning. And Voice Engine is probably still state of the art as far as the speed and quality which it's able to replicate a voice from just like a 6 second sample. There are other systems that do that now, but OpenAI had that for 18 months. They had that 18 yeah. months and they didn't release it. I used it in the videos I produced for OpenAI. And,
wow.
You know, and I would, yeah, because I'd be middle of the edit and I'd just something wasn't said right. And I'd, you know, Slack out, reach the, you know, the researcher, somebody spoke on Slack, say, hey, I can come have you record this if you want, or if you're cool with it, I can just have, you know, use our technology to fix. I always got permission, would never, ever, ever, just to me, like, ethically, I would never, you know, do anything, but they're always like, yeah, of course, please do that. And so that's the funny thing. It's like, it's been out there in front for a while, but we just did not want to release it because the potential for abuse, and there are other companies that have systems like that. I don't think they're as good, but there are people abusing the systems right now. And so OpenAI sat on that, and they didn't even announce it. And finally, they decided to, like, hey, these researchers put in a lot of work. We want to explain where the state of the art is. By the way, it's way further ahead than people realize. So, you know, they released a blog post about that, talked about that. That's happened numerous times. Well, they'll put out a blog post, and it's about something that they've been sitting on for a long time. And I think that part of it is like that they are my. We'll get into the Google second thing, but anyhow, they do that. As far as saying, yeah, they can, and GPT-4.0 was so significant by itself. Had they called it GPT-5, the press would have been like, oh my God, look at how amazing GPT-5 is.
Yeah.
But OpenAI did, and there are people like, oh, they plateaued. That's why they can't do a GPT-5. They're doing this. It's like, well, if they behaved the way people think they behaved, they would call it GPT-5, which they're not.
I would say, yeah, pause. Just pause. Yeah. It's fine. Look, I think what they announced, I mean, to me, if what you're watching in this space, and this is what we've spent a lot of time in, and Andrew, you've spent, you know, several years looking at, is where is the front of the line? Where are we? This is moving very fast, and it is very volatile. Not only is it really exciting to watch the vanguard, but also everything that's coming up behind it that's more sustainable and cheaper in terms of some of the open source models and some of the other stuff that's happening. This is all very, very exciting in real time. But if you're looking at the front of the line, the fact that OpenAI was able to show what an Omni model looks like, that it can go that fast, that it can be demoed in real time, and it can look as slick as it has on both the Mac app and the phone, I do think that it says a lot, and it especially says a lot about what came later in that week, and that is, of course, Google I.O. But before we get to that, we want to remind you that patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show. Head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings.
I want to address one more thing, which is I have no idea what the status of anything is in the release schedule, so let me make that very clear.
Yes.
The thing that tech journalists haven't picked up on, the thing that people now starting to follow the industry haven't picked on and don't realize. It's one of these things where, you know, you'll see this because people talk about, oh, this person left or whatever, what's going to happen? And you're like, that person only worked on this tiny little thing over there that didn't have anything to do with this other stuff. When you know the inside of it, and you're like, oh, you've just seen that name repeated so much. And so you associate things. It's one of our kind of the ways we process stuff incorrectly. And there can also be, you get an expectation. You know, we're used to, there is every fall there's a new iPhone, right?
Yeah.
And they will bury a new iPhone even if all they can do is add more pixels to the screen or change that. They know there's going to be a faster chip, Moore's Law, there's going to be some speed up bump that they can do predictably every year, whatever. There's going to be a new phone. Language models are different. Because every time you have in GPT-1 to GPT-2 was 10x, GPT-2 to GPT-3 was a 10x capability gain, GPT-3 to GPT-4 was like a 10x gain. Every time you have that, you don't just have an increase in capability, you have now the responsibility to spend more time testing it to make sure that it doesn't derail, it doesn't do this. And that is one of the things people do not understand, is that it was 6 months. GPT-4 was done 6 months before OpenAI announced it because they spent that much time trying to test it for safety and figure out how to do this. At a time when there weren't benchmarks, public information, or a lot of data on how to do that, they had to invent all of this stuff. So release cycles for GPT-4 equivalent models from other companies are much shorter. It's not like Meta sits on their model, you know, it's going to sit on a model, their new 400B model, whatever they're working, they're going to sit on that for 6 months before they release. The day they finish training it, you know, you're going to probably hear stuff about it, you know, with maybe. Same kind of, you know, the same thing. Google spends a shorter amount of time. So I'm saying that that's the thing, too, is that you could have a really high end, if there is such a model, it probably exists and it's been being tested. And they're not, and OpenAI is not going to rush out. They're not going to finish a model like that training. They're not going to put out a press release. And people just don't understand it because they're stuck in that other mindset and don't believe them about safety. And they don't believe them about that. And that's why people make bad predictions. It's because if you say, well, I don't think this is true, okay, make a prediction. Well, that's why they're always wrong, because they just make these assumptions that are false.
I will say, from a reporter's perspective, OpenAI is not a particularly leaky organization. And you haven't had a whole lot of people that are leaving angrily or doing tell-alls, right? We have still yet to have a gigantic big book written from the inside of OpenAI in a way that
approached.
We have. Yeah, well, there we go.
I had the producers of a major TV series about corporate intrigue ask me if I wanted. I'm like, no, not a chance.
Well, but that's the thing is look, that stuff is going to come. Eventually somebody's going to write a book. Eventually somebody's going to do a doc. There's going to be something where, you know, there's the empty chair and somebody sits down, tests the mic and then says, you know, well, we started in a different way, right? Like that's eventually going to happen. But right now we don't have it. And because LLMs are so closed, you don't have like a Ming-Chi Kuo who reports on what Apple's going to do based on what he's hearing in China about supply lines that do have to be set in stone years in advance. So I'm curious, you know, I know from your perspective, there's what you knew from at the point that you left. But when you're watching the coverage of it, I can imagine that it's frustrating because a lot of people are guessing and we don't even have the same amount of information that we would have on another company that has been at the vanguard at this point in their history.
I mean, I'll give an example, which is OpenAI puts out a paper talking about improvements in math and having to get the models way better, significant new approach towards math.
Uh-huh.
And then the drama happens of the what did Ilya see and all this stuff. And you hear
Shuffle in last fall.
And did he scared? Was the board scared? Did they have some breakthrough thing?
With Q-Star.
And it's like, and you're like, well, if you follow, you've heard things like that trained, and I've told people, like, well, go look at this research paper on math, like that mathematical reasoning. That's a substantially important paper. And I've said, like, hey, like, the whole, oh, my God, ChatGPT, yeah, read John Shulman talking about for years about, you know, instruction following and stuff. And it's like, it's there. It's all there, but you need somebody screaming, and sometimes it's somebody who really doesn't understand it who's going, oh, my God. And people are like, oh, that guy must be an expert. And so right now they're just filled with just – it's just dumb out there. I'm going to put it that way. And it is. And I hear, you'll hear a thread will get, I look at a thread, they're like, oh, well, you know, I think this person here, because it's like something a couple of weeks ago, this person leaving, well, that must, I'm like, hey, they're not in any of the papers. Like, go look through the papers to see if that person was actually key to anything. And it's like,
try to find their name in the research.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, I'm in the GPT-4 paper. That person's not, so tell me, you know. So, and not that they didn't do meaningful contributions. But anyhow, point
sure,
is.
Sure, yes, yes.
There is
they
a lot of
they also didn't perform on cruise ships.
True that. And circuses, too. Let's not forget
and
that.
Circuses.
Yeah. So it gets to be kind of crazy. People are trying to figure this stuff out, and we like the sensational story. And, yeah, there's going to be stuff. And I'd say that, too, there's a number of people leaving right now. That's because – it could be from
some tweet threads, some viral tweet threads about OpenAI that I was reading before we started.
Yeah, I would say that sometimes there are financial events that take place in companies, and then you get a lot of people who leave, and always weigh that in to say if they say they're leaving on principle, but also like, well, didn't you? There's a lot of other people leaving right now too, and there must be something maybe took place. That can be a factor, you know, like it's the kind of thing where maybe you know, that was a contributing factor and stuff. And the orgs get bigger. You know, there are 1,000 more people at OpenAI than when I started. And so I made my decision to move on because, like, I had a great role, but I just realized I'm not going to have the flexibility that I had before to kind of work on a bunch of different stuff at once because guess what? They had the smartest people in the world now working on those things. And so it wasn't like, I'll pick that up. Like, well, actually, we got, I think that, and as it takes a direction, you know, and it's funny because, like, when I was there when Dario and the rest, they went to go create Anthropic. And I think very highly of the Anthropic people, and make it very clear. I think they're incredibly smart. They have their own approaches about how they want to approach developing stuff. And some of the things that they do make a lot of sense to me. And actually, as somebody, they're very much in the world of words and language and stuff. And as a writer, some of this makes sense to me. And I go, yeah, I think there's something to that there. I think there's an interesting approach. Their ideas on safety are different than mine. Like, I have a, you know, as a coder, I look at a thing like, tell me your scary situation and I'll see if I can't do it in Python in 2 days.
Yeah.
So that being said, they left because the Microsoft deal for them, they felt that was a compromise. They felt like they were unhappy with the sort of the idea that OpenAI making that. They, of course, then took money from Sam Bankman-Fried and Eric Schmidt and now partnered with, you know, Amazon and Google. And so I think the reality of how to pursue these things may have changed them. I don't think they've changed their core belief system. I think they're still very sincere, but things change over time. And over time,
you are a fan of their products. I know you've talked a lot about their
Claude,
especially
really, really, really good model. Very good. I think they're doing really good stuff. And certainly a petty part of me would like to just be critical. Like, they do good stuff. Their approach is constitutional AI, which is an approach they have towards improving stuff. Really key. They are doing some really good stuff. So my point is things change over time. And for them, they had a viewpoint back in 2020 about how they wanted to build an AI company. And they had said they were just going to do research. Maybe they were sincere, but I was telling everybody, no, they're going to be an AI company. They're going to become a competitor.
Yeah.
Exactly what happened. It was they made, and I don't think that they were necessarily going out the door misleading anybody. They're young. I'm have the benefit of experience and being an older person.
It's just the reality of what's going to happen and the kind of money that's going to come in.
And we all benefit because I think they're making great products.
Yeah.
So anyhow, what happens is you often look at the world in a certain way, and then you realize as the technology develops, the world changes. And either you agree with what everybody else sees it, or you see it differently. And that can happen at a company like OpenAI. Remember, back when they first started, people thought maybe you could develop AGI on just a desktop computer with a really clever algorithm. And that's why a certain prominent mogul started selling AI systems with the promise that soon they'd be able to handle AGI level tasks. And they almost 10 years later, they can't. And he's upset. And read into that as he will. And people have varied. And you have to sort of constantly sit there and look at how things are changing. So that's that. Google.
Let's talk about Google. So Google I/O follows the next day. Obviously, this is the context now for Google I/O is not going to be them being able to step out onto the center stage and present things without context. Everything is going to be put in context of OpenAI's announcement. What did Google announce, and in your view, how does it stack up?
So, I'm going to say this again. Google has incredible researchers, incredible teams. I have friends there. And Google has the benefit of having hundreds of products and places to deploy AI. Google also has the technical burden of having hundreds of products and hundreds of places they have to deploy AI. OpenAI gets to focus in a few critical key areas, which means the management structure from, you know, and by the way, Mira Murati, who did the presentation for OpenAI, I think she did a great job. She's her CTO. You know, you're getting Sam, Mira, Greg, and a few others to come into consensus on a thing and deciding across the org what's going to happen. That's hard. That's hard for Sundar to call all the stakeholders into a room and say, this is what we're going to do and this is what we need to have happen. And one, get a consensus and have everybody on there and to be able to make that out. So it is, Google has a big burden they have to deal with. Has its advantages and disadvantages. So Google, one, they showed, you know, how they're going to deploy AI across the range of products they have, which sounds great, you know, but it is one thing to think as a researcher how it would be cool to put AI into Gmail. It's another thing to think about, do I even need Gmail? That's the thing. That would say that was my issue there was, you know, we saw a lot of stuff that we'd seen Microsoft demo before too a year ago. Microsoft had demoed many of these same kinds of integrations, and there's been a lot of pressure on Google that, well, you guys are Google, you should be in the lead on this. And when they did their last big announcement, They were trying to show off, you know, Gemini Ultra, look how great we are. Look, we beat GPT-4. And then as people started to do their own independent evals, they realized, oh, you just compared it to the version of GPT-4 that was almost a year old. You didn't, you know, compare it to the latest version, and some of these other evals you're hiding are really bad, MMLU, whatever. And so they realized like that people were expecting that Google was going to have this big, they were going to have like a GPT-5 level model or something big. And it turned out they barely had a GPT-4 level model before. And that was a big adjustment for a lot of people because what's going on? Now, let me make it clear. Google's got DeepMind and super smart people. I mean, if I'm going to make a bet on who could in theory develop an amazing cool, I think they can. I just don't know that in the structure.
They got a lot of money. They got a lot of brains, and they got a lot of data. And those are the recipes. If you were going to say in a lab what you need to lead in this market, those are the three things. It's a list of three.
And a week before, they had an announcement, you know, DeepMind had a really big breakthrough with basically doing, you know, for medical capabilities and protein sequencing and stuff. Like, they're doing amazing stuff. And so that when it comes to, you know, the problem I had with the Google I announcement was they certainly showed how it was going to be deployed. Gemini Ultra disappeared. That was the model they talked about before. And so we have Gemini Pro 1.5. They're unlike
Google to just disappear brands and change names on things. So very different.
The three biggest things people talked about. Number one is they've expanded the context window. That's the amount of text or data that you can put into the model to now like a 2 million token context window, which means, you know, you can take, 20 novels and put it in there. You can take,
I believe
they that, say,
that there was there on the road to infinite context.
Yeah. You can take, let's say like 2 hours of video, but what does that mean? It means like you can take, you know, at what frame rate? I can take X number of in frames or whatever, this much audio. It is a really good, is a key development. The question is that the problem is you can input it, but how well does it reason across that? So I can build a model that I could say can take a billion context window model, and then you go ask it questions, and it'll have no idea about any of that context, right? So there are tests called Needle in the Haystack and other things like that, and that's where they found some of these models with really big context aren't really that great. They miss things. They can't remember everything. When I would test, I have my own test I used to use back in the early GPT-3 days where I'd give it a list of 200 items and I'd be like, what's it item 199? What's it item 150? And I could see, and that's how I measured every new model is I would go do my own informal long context test for retrawl. It's called Needle in the Haystack now, but that was just like, I had a little way to do that. So point is, it's cool, but it's also your token cost, you know, you have to pay per token. It actually gets more expensive the bigger the context. It would, to use a 2 million context window would be $15. So
it's a lot of money.
And so it's like, what would you do? I have a friend that's there. He's asked a question like, what would you do with a 2 million context window? I'm like, I don't know. Go into credit card debt?
Yeah. Ask for an allowance? Ask for a grant?
Because like that's like, bro, like every time I want to, if I put all my books into there and every time I want to hit it, and I've written 2 million tokens worth of context, but man, it'd be awesome to be able to make a query across them. But not at $15 a piece. I'm going to pick them up and read them, you know. So that will get better over time. But that'd say that it's a thing that people got excited about, but nobody thought about. Nobody pulled out a spreadsheet and said, "What is this?" Oh, if they said, "Hey, for $15, you could do this," you'd be like, "Oh, that's not good." They clearly were feeling the hurt from, because remember they did the demo the last time. They did this demo, overhead camera, and the guy says, you know, it's like, okay, Gemini, you know, what, you know. And like
it is deliberately there to sound like this was 4 o'clock in the morning. This is the breakthrough of AI.
Fake analog tape recorder sound up at the beginning is a thing. And that is a production guy that made me cringe when
you are faking this. Somebody put that effort into it to Hollywood it up.
It's cringy enough when you have to watch, you know, YouTubers sit down and go, well, let me tell you the thing, you know, the people coming in and sitting down as they start to talk. It was that level times 10 cringe. So anyway, they did the demo, and then people got excited because it looked cool. Because here's this AI, and I'd see people like, "Oh man, I want to have this. I'm going to put this in my meeting right away. Imagine doing this, doing this." What? And I had to explain this to people who were in the field because everybody just assumed it was pretty much what it was.
Yeah.
And I went and pulled up because I'm like, once I heard the little, once I'm like, oh, this, there's a lot of fakery going on here.
Yeah. This is the demo. The demo from several months ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I pulled out the paper. I go in there and I look at it. And like, one, they weren't doing a quote. What does a multimodal video model mean is up for debate. And me, it's basically not doing individual frames. It's basically having an encoder that works across frames and can do it in a more efficient way. They were basically what that demo was, is everything they did in there. I'm like, I could have done it. I had GPT-4 V demos that I wanted to do, but we're like, that's a little bit too, you know, everything it did GPT-4 V could do. Cause all you had to do was every in seconds, send a frame and send your audio.
Yeah.
Right. Just basically grab a frame every few seconds and have it have an understanding of what's going in there. Wait for a person to ask a question, do a thing. So technically it was a thing you could have done a year earlier. But then it was funny was some reporter had asked, like, hey, was it taking the voice input? And they're like, no, we typed those questions in.
It was a text. Yeah. That was a reproduced voice of text prompts.
Yeah, and so time wasn't right. The same way it didn't. The thing that got exciting was the idea that it was a real time conversation with an AI, where you're just talking to it and it sees and it does things. That was what people assumed it did, and that is not what it did. And yes, it had vision capabilities, but it didn't have the stuff. And what is new here? Well, there wasn't anything new there. They're like, oh, it does video, like. GPT-4V takes video frames, can take frames of video and interpret. I tweeted that out, showed that. But anyhow, so that was the frustration there was they didn't do that. So then OpenAI shows GPT-4O, which does do that. It grabs, you know, a frame every few seconds or looks for, I don't know what they're doing. You know, there's ways you can do it where you can basically look for scene changes or use an embedding space to see if there's a dramatic shift, whatever. You know, grabs frames every few seconds, whatever, and does that. And they did the demo in real time with less latency and super fast. And they showed, hey, there's a really cool thing.
It certainly appears there's a demo on their YouTube where two people are playing rock, paper, scissors.
Yep.
And that shot in real time appears like that is happening in real time. And that is far more what it looked like that Google demo was doing.
Yeah. They did another demo, another video worth checking out. Like I said, there is gold in there that people just haven't dug into, of a GPT-4O watching a Skype meeting, and they're discussing,
cats,
Lillian,
versus dogs.
Yeah, Lillian Wing taking the dog position, and I know one of our product managers there is a big, big cat person, so that might have been controversial. But anyhow, it identified the speaker by an image and voice. Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. And that it gets lost. You're like, wait, it knew who spoke.
Yes.
And it knew.
All they had to do was say their names.
Yep.
And then say their positions. They did not need to say, hey, remember this. They did not need to set it up. They just said their names at the beginning as if you were announcing yourself in a meeting. And at the end, the model was able to give the notes of the meeting.
And that was in the middle of it, interact. Well, who said this? So-and-so said this. That was an amazing demo that could have been by itself a standalone. OpenAI could have just done an entire demo like, hey, look at this new thing, GPT-4O for meetings, and look how it keeps track of it. We're blown it away. So Google has their announcement.
All right. I know my parody video. I'm just going to feed it all of the Nixon tapes and then just have OpenAI summarize each meeting of the Nixon tapes. Anyway, go ahead. So Google now here at I.O.
So Google... One, they talk about the big context window, which I think is great, and technically it's a good achievement. We'll see over time how it tests out for that, but I think I love the fact they're pushing that. They came out with a new model called Gemini Pro 1.5 Flash. So to understand, OpenAI had a high volume usage for ChatGPT, and it was hard to meet the demand for that. So what they did is they created GPT 3.5 Turbo. And the turbo basically is a model where you try to shrink that bottle down to make it as efficient as you can, but still retain key capabilities, which means you can just make it cheaper and easier and serve more people. So that's one of the reasons why OpenAI has been able to continue a generous free tier, whatever. So then they had GPT-4 Turbo. And so turbo models tend to be, that's OpenAI's way of saying, this is our faster, cheaper version that's pretty much capable like the other one. And that's become a big thing because speed is super critical. One of my favorite companies, GROQ, it's Grok. It's not the same as Elon's model. It's a company that makes hardware, Grok. If you go to GROQ.com.
Great website, Grok.
Super fast, insanely fast. They can do like, 700 tokens, a second, just super fast. But faster models are super useful in a lot of ways, particularly, getting the latency down was critical for GPT-4o because how do I talk to this thing and not have it wait and look at a spinning thing? Because when you use it right now, it's annoying.
Yeah.
So Google announced their Flash model, which is a very fast, very cheap model. Anthropic had come out with Haiku, which was their very, very cheaper version of their Claude. And Haiku is a very good model, very good, smaller model, capable of a lot of things. And so that's sort of the thing. Now you have to have your high-end frontier model, and you got to have a really capable fast model that's cheap because there's a lot of API opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
So Google came out with that, which was good. And so that was, their other big sort of announcement was, hey, look, we understand this. We're going to put this out there. Then, obviously frustrated by the demo from several months ago, and in particular, like I said before, at the time, the thing that frustrated me about that demo was for researchers at Google who are capable of building things like that and capable stuff, is when it came out that was faked, they have to hear, oh, Google couldn't do it, or Google, and they're like, and I don't think it was the researcher's idea to do that fake demo. That sounds like a bunch of
marketing
consulting
people.
Company hires working at Google who are like, we got to show this and prove to the world we're doing this. It's like, well, there's a reputational cost. So DeepMind, they showed a demo of Astra, and so Astra was very, very similar to the demo that OpenAI had done, where they had a person, you saw a person holding a phone and then talking to it. It felt like it was a VO, it's fine. But I'd say that the problem with the VO over that, then I don't know. Anyhow, either here nor there. It was recorded live, like continuous take, because they knew they got heat last
time. We can't look like this is a production. This has to look like a live demo.
Yeah, so pre-recorded. So
let me just say this. I've been very critical of Google, specifically in the field of AI on Daily Tech News Show. For anybody who listens to that, I have said that Sundar Pichai is going to get fired because of his mismanagement on this. So my position on this is very, very clear. We will the history will tell us whether or not I am correct, or I'm too harsh, or I'm too lenient. But I, for me personally, Google has burnt trust enough that I don't believe demos from them. I need to see the product in my hand, or I can't get hyped on a demo from them anymore, because we're just in a space now where we're not talking about concept cars. We're talking about drag racing. So don't show me what you think you are going to be able to do. Don't pre-record stuff. Do it. Release it. That's the level that we're at right now. It's moving fast.
Well, so two things. One, it was done at DeepMind reputationally. I put high confidence in them,
I would say.
Second,
yeah,
they did have in-person demonstrations of a form of Astra that people could go do, but it was a Google presenter with a microphone doing it, and people talked to them and saying, go do this, do that. So I'd say that, what OpenAI did is they did a live demo, which have to give them credit, because you could saw it can make some mistakes and stuff, but overall it worked great. And people walked away going, this felt real and amazing and live, and they didn't fake it. Google showed you a continuous take out of how many takes, we don't know. How much context did they have? We don't know. They gave it a problem. They gave it everything. Every problem they put in front of it was obviously something to handle before. OpenAI ostensibly took a request from the internet to say, hey, want to try something, which... Yeah. Again, if it's asked for something stupid, then we're going to do that. Let's be honest. But they did do live. They did do live demos of that. And so I would say that was the difference. Like Google did they showed us a recording of the thing working, doing anything it would do. I would say my crit of that is I could have built that demo using GPT-4V as it is, because the latency, that was not a fast thing. And I could have used just a ton. I could have used, you know, three models working simultaneously, taking images and doing this stuff. So I don't know what was really going on there. You know, the demo that we saw, GPT-4o, you know, it was on an iPhone running with a cable just to give them an internet connection. So who knows? But anyhow,
we've seen some videos of people using 4o like out in the wild. I've seen, you know, YouTube videos of the iPhone app. So it's like, it seems to be in people's hands. Look, if 4o isn't in people's hands in 6 months, then I'll change my opinion. But right now it looks like OpenAI is showing us things that we are going to be playing with in weeks. And Google is showing us that they are close to a thing that we have no idea when it's going to show up. And in Google's estimation, they don't have a great track record.
And here's the thing. The pre-recorded demo, highly controlled demo that Google did of Astra wasn't as cool as what we saw OpenAI show live and working. Yeah. That was the big takeaway. It was slower. We didn't see the things, too, that we remember is Astra part of, you know, Astra showed you, hey, we're doing, we did the thing. Here's the thing we told you 6 months ago, now we're actually going to do it. Latency was really big compared to GPT-4o. Also, I implore people listening to this, go to OpenAI's channel, watch the other demos in there, because you will see the voice model do things you have never seen a voice model do before. Like, hey, can you repeat that back to me like a robot? Okay, yeah. I am a ba 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 ba. Okay, can you speak it slower? Okay.
Count faster. Let's count slower. Count faster. Sing it. Harmonize.
They just done a release on that alone, the problem was there was so much in that GPT-4o demo and those other demos, people still haven't processed them. And so then you get Astra, which is like, hey, look, we're doing the thing. Like, yeah, it's cool. It's actually kind of less cool than what you showed me 6 months ago. And it's certainly nowhere near as cool as what OpenAI is claiming is running on iPhones right now. So,
yeah. Again, you know, my position has been very clear. I think that it is a shame that Google is not further ahead. I don't think that it's the money. I don't think that it's the brains. I don't think that it's the data. I think that it's the management. And I would like for them to be better, because I don't want them to be lagging behind. I want them to be at the forefront of this race, pushing this thing as fast as possible, because there's really cool stuff here. And every time that we push the boundary farther, not only is the vanguard cool, but again, everything that becomes commonplace behind it, that's what's really exciting, because that's the kind of stuff that just gets baked into every website ever that just makes the world so much more exciting and interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that they're really pushing the frontiers in a lot of areas. And we talked about before, some of the DeepMind stuff, the medical stuff, things like this. And I think that they are going to miserably improve the quality of life for people on this planet. And I think their technologies are going to help, you know, cure diseases, improve the quality of life for that. And so I do not want to like dismiss Google. I think that in the area where they're trying to compete with a company that has been taken, like I said, like to the person that was, you know, comment online, the writer who said that like, oh, OpenAI got lucky. I'm like, 5 years ago, July, Microsoft did a $1 billion bet with OpenAI, and OpenAI had made this pitch. That's 5 years coming to get to this point, to very much where they knew where we were going to be. They've been thinking about this longer. And GPT-3 came out, and you could see there was significant. And Sundar did not open up the checkbook and start throwing money at his LLM people.
Yeah,
people from there were coming to OpenAI because they didn't have the resources, because Google didn't care. They didn't care. And so you had a number of great people at OpenAI came from Google because Google wasn't making that bet.
Wasn't spending the money. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when it's that like, that's lucky. I'm like, no, it's believing in a future, believing in a version of future and betting everything on it.
Well, I believe now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that this is a good conversation on AI, and we will have many, many more in the future.
Andrew, we hit the wall.
Is that it? Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed our AI coverage forever.
One thing on the wall thing, and this is the thing I tweeted yesterday. There's this people going, oh, we think we hit the wall. They must have hit the wall, right? I'm like, okay. Less than 300 people built GPT-4. Yeah. Less than 300 people built GPT-4. The number of people working in the entire field was probably 10 times smaller than now. So now you have 10 times as many people we've had all these other incredible developments, learning different methods from different, you know, different even for even non-transformer architectures, Mamba, all this sort of stuff. The smartest people in the world are now coming to AI and are now working on it. And you mean to tell me that's they're not going to be able to outdo what OpenAI did?
Well, yeah, that's very silly.
I think it's the graph. You've seen there's this graph of like, you know, somebody who's a Mercatus Center person, which I respect, but they show, well, you know, ever since the Wright brothers flight, you know, flight speeds have leveled off. We haven't increased exponentially. And I'm like, okay, well, it was by the time they had the Wright brothers Flyer 3, 5 years later, the fastest flying creatures on the planet were humans and airplanes. So yeah. We surpassed biology. So are you telling me that we're about to surpass the human brain? Then okay, yeah. Cool. But I think you're not trying to say that.
No. Maine, do you have any picks?
I do have a pick.
What's that?
Norm MacDonald said a joke back in the 90s. Let me get the time frame here. That, you know, he had this habit of making jokes or saying, you know, he had this habit of sometimes somebody says a thing and it just stays with you forever because it's applicable for whatever. In 1994, a movie directed by Neil Jordan was released starring Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, which was the film adaptation of Interview with a Vampire.
Yes.
And do you remember Norm MacDonald's review of it?
No.
Not gay enough. a great way to say it. So there is an AMC series based on Interview with a Vampire.
Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, first season. It stars Grey Worm. Grey Worm is there. He plays Louis. Eric Bogosian is the interviewer, and they do a wonderful framing device. Because the original book took place, like originally the interviews were like in 1973 or whatever it's supposed to take place. And the idea, and they, what they do there is the interviewer, they are 1970s because of the book, but yeah, the interviewer basically, it's as if that happened. Is if that happened and now it's modern day and the interviewer is going back, Bogosian is going back to go talk to Louis. To get the real story. Tell me what really happened. Because I think you went hell. And it just brilliant framing device, I think, you know. They update it. Like, this takes place in, like, the 1920s in takes place like 1970, you know, takes place like in the old stuff happens like in 1910s, 1920s, whatever.
Gotcha.
Et cetera. And I do want to side note, the original idea, I think, of like doing that recording of this, I think was Fred Saberhagen, the Dracula tapes, which were recordings of this, which came out before, like 2 years before Anne Rice's book, but they're both great in sort of the way to do it. But anyhow, don't worry, Norm. Plenty gay.
Yeah, there we go. Smiling from heaven, Norm MacDonald. Finally, enough Interview with a Vampire.
Well, and I mean, I don't, as a straight guy, I don't know. I mean, there are people, there may be gay people there.
They might still be one. They might still demand.
It doesn't hide that it's a romance between two. I guess what we say is it doesn't hide this is really a romance between two men. You know, and I think that, and given that when the first movie was made and who was casting, like, they did a remarkable job of like, yeah, this is kind of queer, guys, just so you know. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, this is about, you know,
a romance between two men. Yeah.
Yeah. The romantic life of a vampire. Like I said, what do I know? Coming into it, but it was like one of these things like, our flag means death, you know, which is like these are really well-developed characters and I enjoy it. And maybe I don't personally, you know, understand that life or relate to it specifically, but I feel like I like the characters. I'm invested in them and in their outcomes, even though what I love about Interview with a Vampire, these are monsters. It's like what we do in the shadows. Like, these are the worst.
These are bad people.
The worst things in the
bad
world.
Bad things, not even people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you get invested in their emotions and their life, and you root for them, even though that means they're going to go murder a family of five and then come back to the dinner table and argue about something. So anyhow, I've enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. The new Interview with the Vampire series. Highly recommend it if you're into that kind of thing.
My pick is OpenAI's channel on YouTube, because I really haven't watched anything over the last week or so. So go ahead and check those out. Those demos are fantastic.
Awesome. It's been weird.